Kia ora, welcome to episode 58 of the SWNZ podcast, the podcast for New Zealand Star Wars fans. My name is Matt.
And my name is Christy.
It was another great week for news from a galaxy far, far away, mainly again because of the Book of Boba Fett really hitting its stride. So let's jump in and talk Star Wars. First, let's just have a bit of a quick roundup of news from around the internet. A number of these items are actually about the Book of Boba Fett, but we will get in and talk about last week's episode, episode 2 of the Book of Boba Fett, very shortly. There's been a couple of interviews with the stars of the Book of Boba Fett on various news outlets, and the actors have some interesting things to say, which are just kind of fun to hear about their background and about their perspective on playing Star Wars characters. I think we mentioned last podcast that Jennifer Beals did an interview with Harper's Bazaar, but I just want to hit on that again because, yeah, she goes into a little bit of depth about the conversations she's had with Ming-Na Wen, who's been quite supportive for her and the significance of joining the Star Wars universe. A question is put to Jennifer Beals by Harper's Bazaar. You're part of the Star Wars canon now. People will be cosplaying as Madame Gossip Whip, and there are already pages about your character and role. That's pretty incredible. And Jennifer responds, that's what Ming-Na Wen said was going to happen. I mean, Madame Gasa is extraordinary. She is not like any other Twi'lek we've seen. She's enormously wealthy and the costumes are extraordinary. Shauna, the show's costume designer, and I were talking about yoga, meditation, and dreams in our first meeting, and she said, if anything regarding this character comes up in your meditation or your dreams, please let me know. So I sent her these images that came to me, and she incorporated them into my costumes. It was incredible to me. My understanding is she's talking about some elements of her headdress around her earrings and so forth that she actually contributed design aspects to. So I think that's kind of fun. And yeah, she's been learning a lot about what it means to be part of the Star Wars universe. It's quite new to her, which is very interesting, but she seems very receptive to the role and to be enjoying it.
Yeah, it's good that people, obviously there's always two sides of a coin. Jumping into a big franchise like Star Wars is the fact that no matter your role, large or small, you're going to get a fan following, and that's really fun in certain respects. But of course, everything about your appearance is going to be sort of studied, yeah, and replicated, obviously, with costuming organizations like the 501st Legion and the Rebel Legion. They'll be looking at all the details and things like that. So it might make you a little bit sort of self-conscious knowing that your portrayal will be analyzed so tightly by a huge group of fans. But in the same way, you know that for the most part, those fans are going to be incredibly excited about your involvement. So it comes sort of, you know, with a bit of both. But if you take on a positive edge, like she seems to be in these interviews, then that bodes well for her.
You bring up an interesting point about costuming because, yeah, fans love the detail. Costuming fans and fans of new characters and so forth just love the detail. And we're seeing so much depth of detail and really visually interesting characters and costumes and other aspects of Star Wars coming through in the Book of Boba Fett. It's really an exciting aspect of it. And I'm really getting a great vibe. I think it really feels like it's part of Tatooine and like it's stemmed from the original trilogy and even, you know, references to the prequel trilogy and so forth. It feels really, really in-world in a fantastic way.
I like the note about the costume designer wanting to incorporate sort of input into a costume, not speaking from experience, but I would imagine that, you know, if you have a bit of a hand in the involvement in an outfit that your character wears, it helps kind of really connect with that character, especially in the setting of Star Wars, which is obviously sort of, you know, not in reality. They're not wearing jeans and t-shirts here. So I think that that's kind of fun and a nod to just the creativity on the show that is a collaborative effort. They want little bits and pieces in there. I have to say, I really enjoy seeing the input that Tim has obviously brought to the character. So I can imagine that would reverberate through and have the other actors being able to bring things to the roles.
Yeah, well, both Tamara Morrison and Ming-Na Wen have been talking a lot as well in a number of different interviews. I think there's a video interview with Entertainment Tonight where they go into a few interesting details and almost let a few minor spoilers slip. And they also do together, they've been working together in a lot of their interviews, an interview with Rolling Stone magazine. And just talking about, you know, Tamara's characterization of Boba Fett, he makes some interesting comments about acting while he's got the helmet on that I thought were really interesting. Tim says this, he says, but, you know, funnily enough, I think on The Mandalorian, they could tell if it wasn't me. Robert Rodriguez would say, I can tell it's not you if you're not under that helmet. My face would act through the helmet. I don't know how that goes, but if there's an Oscar for best performance under a helmet, I'm going to win it. I think what he's kind of saying there is that obviously there's a few scenes where someone else is portraying Boba Fett with the helmet on, but he really wants to own the character. He wants to play the character when he's got the helmet on as well as the helmet off. I think I remember from another interview that he was really relieved that even back in The Mandalorian, DeLorean, he got to take his helmet off once he got on board Slave Island, board into the cockpit of a starship, because it didn't make a lot of sense when he's not fighting, when he's not preparing to fight or in danger, to be wearing his helmet. So he was able to set a precedent. I think the director back then was Rick Fumiawa, agreed to it at that point. So he sort of set this precedent that he could do a lot more acting with the helmet off. But what he's saying there is he does enjoy, and he believes that it's recognisable that, you know, when you act with the helmet on, it makes a difference if it is the same actor under the helmet. So I think that's kind of interesting.
I think body language and just the way that you sort of hold yourself does really sort of come through. Obviously, there's so much subtleties to Pedro Pascal's performance as the Mandalorian that sort of you don't even need to see his face. So it's almost like a really complicated mime exercise to see how it comes through. But it's kind of interesting, like you say, him taking his helmet off while he's in the cockpit of Slave One. If we think back to Empire Strikes Back, when he's tracking the Millennium Falcon, we see him piloting Slave One with his helmet on, but yeah. We know Django did not.
Yep.
So I think possibly what really helped with in the setting of the Mandalorian was really differentiating the other Mandalorians from Din Djarin, who kept his helmet on all the time. And I think seeing the likes of Bo-Katan and Boba Fett wear their helmet off all the time really put that in sort of a stark contrast. I think that really helped, and it obviously bode well for the Book of Boba Fett. So we're, you know, getting a little bit more differentiation than just watching another helmeted Mandalorian character have adventures. So we're getting that sort of different flavor here with Tim.
Okay, I just want to mention a quick bit of other non-Book of Boba Fett news in our news roundup. If you're a fan of Star Wars video games, there's a bit of conversation online about the sequel to Jedi Fallen Order, with rumors of a footage reveal being anticipated to show up at the Celebration convention taking place in May the 26th this year. Jedi Fallen Order was a well-received game, so it'd be really great to see a sequel to this. My understanding is that it won't actually be called Jedi Fallen Order 2 or anything like that. It'll start with the prefix Star Wars Jedi, and then a subsequent main title to represent the game and to represent where the game is heading. So that'll be coming from EA. And slightly older news, but just interesting to mention in the same mouthful, is there's again word on the street that EA is actually working on at least one other Star Wars game at this point in time, expecting a single player story driven game potentially coming out from them. Not a lot of solid detail on that, but even though it's pretty lightweight in terms of rumors, I love hearing about the potential for ongoing Star Wars games and single players, multiplayers. I like the mix, and I like a balance between the both.
I remember a little while after Jedi Fallen Order had come out, and there was online chatter saying that for a long time it felt as though the executives at EA felt that Star Wars fans didn't want a story game. They wanted Battlefront. They want the big action games where you just get out your blasters and shoot at people.
Battlefront was dominating at that point in time, and it's a Star Wars skin over existing first player type games.
It's really interesting, because I know that the fan chatter was Jedi Fallen Order was great, and that's exactly the sort of thing that they wanted, and everyone was kind of crossing their fingers that on the spreadsheets that it did well enough financially for EA to realize the error of their ways and to start making more Star Wars games that have storylines, you know, particularly since they don't have the exclusive rights to Star Wars games now, that there's competition. And I know some people said that they were worried what was going to happen, but other people were anticipating that the threat of competition would make EA buck up and actually do something with the license. Because when you look back, they've actually done very few Star Wars games over like the last 10 years. There've been what felt like years where there were no Star Wars games coming out when we look back in the past, and there's a huge array of fantastic games that are still popular and beloved to this day. So I'm hoping that these progressions, and certainly the sequel to Jedi Fallen Order, bode well for getting some more storyline games. I think when it comes to video games, a lot of Star Wars fans are not necessarily hardcore gamers, and the idea of jumping into a big PvP arena with people that are very, very experienced at what they do is just a little intimidating. I know I was intimidated playing online games against other players, and I'm just like, I just want to sit here by myself and play a Star Wars story. And for a while, it really didn't feel like there was much on offer for people for that. So I'm really glad that the Jedi Fallen Order did so well, and I'm really looking forward to seeing any teaser trailers, footage, or anything for the sequel.
So likely a few months before we hear anything more about that, but we'll be keeping our ears peeled and reporting on it as that information becomes available. Let's talk about a few local store reports and related product announcements. First up on our list from New Zealand Mint, just out today, and New Zealand Mint's Silver Chibi coin line, their first Book of Boba Fett character, which not surprisingly is Boba Fett, comes in two versions, a standard $149 version and a $300 special first 100 numbered deluxe case versions. Chibi coins sell out fast at the time of recording. They are still available, both versions at those price points, but I don't think he'll be around for too much longer. In terms of action figures, with the holiday season sort of winding up and everything sort of hitting stride in terms of shipping and so forth, and now we're starting to see the new waves of Black Series figures, 6-inch figures, hitting multiple retailers. The wave that includes Tech, Orison, Cosco Reeves, General Lando, and Q90 have been spotted at multiple retailers, including The Warehouse, and people that have pre-ordered them from online stores, including the smaller retailers, have been receiving those. That's quite a cool wave, but it seems to be well distributed, so it shouldn't be too hard to get most of those. Mighty Ape has them all listed as ready to ship right now. And in terms of vintage collection, 3.75 inch action figure, a few updates. The current wave that's available includes IG-11 and the Emperor and Empire Strikes Back Lando. That's again available from multiple retailers. We're expecting over the next little while to come out in the TVC line the Navarro playset. That's expected in a couple of weeks at the end of January. A lot of people have pre-orders in for that from a variety of retailers. And then the next waves to come out in the TVC line will be Lobot and Bib Fortuna, expected at the start of February. And then closer to the end of March, a Death Watch Mandalorian and the first Book of Boba Fett TVC figures, Boba Fett and Fennec Shand. These are all available to pre-order from Mighty Ape right now as well. One thing that's a little bit different that cropped up on our radar is a series of Star Wars cross-stitch kits available at Spotlight stores. If you're into cross-stitch or know someone that's into cross-stitch, these might interest you. Quite a wide range and quite a wide price range, starting at $14 and going up to $30 for single characters. And then a few other interesting sets like a $35 bunting kit available at Spotlight stores around New Zealand.
It's fun to see crafts that target more of women, female Star Wars fans. Obviously, the merchandise we're seeing in the modern era is coming because we've got the juggernaut of Disney merchandising coming behind it. The concept of Disney cross-stitch is well established. You can buy some very, very expensive, very detailed Disney cross-stitch sets. But I really like the style of these ones. They are cute, sort of animated style. I think they work. Not too complicated. They'd be good if you're wanting to pick up a kit to try out, yeah, to see if you like the activity, or giving to school-age children, yeah, to try right. That sort of craft, a great sort of
holiday activity.
Yeah, I think it's fun. The style works for kids, but it's also not too detailed in that. So if you're a novice, and something cute, even if you are very experienced with the craft.
All right, let's stick with tradition and dive in and talk about the second episode of The Book of Boba Fett, which screened last Wednesday. Episode 2 of The Book of Boba Fett was entitled The Tribes of Tatooine. This was written by Jon Favreau, who also wrote Episode 1, which kind of explains why those two episodes dovetail together so nicely and why they're integrated so strongly together. And it was directed by Steph Green. Now, Steph Green has also directed other TV series like episodes of The Watchmen, Luke Cage, and interestingly, The L Word, Generation Q, whose lead star is also Jennifer Beals. So she has a relationship with the actress who plays Gaza Fwip. Interesting to see that sort of connection going on, and that seems to crop up quite a lot with Star Wars. We'll talk about one other in a few moments. It's a bit of a connection from past work of people involved in Star Wars. Okay, a quick synopsis of Episode 2. Boba Fett and Fennec Shand are interrogating the assassin that they captured last week, who claims, briefly, it's a little bit hard to pick up at the point in the conversation, but he claims to have been hired by the mayor of Mos Espa, who turns out to be Mok Shaiz, the Ithorian. So Fett and Shand go to visit Mok Shaiz. He denies that he hired the assassin and, in fact, kills the assassin, perhaps to cover things up, we don't know yet. He does offer payment to Fett for capturing the assassin, and Fett kind of says this is the tribute that should have been paid when we were having this conversation with the Majordomo last week. And Mok Shaiz suggests to Fett and Shand that they should go visit the sanctuary again because there's things going on that they should know about and that might help sort of uncover the story, the bigger picture. So they do that, and Gus's whip informs Fett that two of Jabba's cousins, a pair of huts known as the Twins, want to claim Jabba's throne and land and sort of dominance for themselves. At that time, the Twins actually arrive, carried by litter through the streets of Mos Espa, and try to intimidate Fett, and the Wookiee bounty hunter Black Kersantan is introduced at that point. Fett refuses to submit. After a little bit of tension, the huts back down, but things clearly are not over at this point. That's about all we see for the current timeline before we switch back to flashback mode via Back to Tank Dreams, where Fett remembers his time with the Tuskens. He goes through training montages with his training gaffy stick. And while they're doing that, they're attacked by a spice train run by the Pike Syndicate. They're obviously causing havoc for the Tuskens. And Boba Fett comes up with an idea when he sees one of the other Tatooine biker gangs, speeder bike gangs. He comes up with an idea to tackle the train head on. But in order to do this, he needs to steal the speeder bikes from the biker gang. That encounter with the bike again takes place at Toshi Station, which is a great flashback to a deleted scene from Star Wars A New Hope. And again, we go to another training montage where Boba Fett teaches the Tuskens how to ride the speeders, and they concoct a plan to take on the train, which they successfully do in a pretty intense and exciting series of scenes. By helping the Tuskens in this way, by getting rid of this threat, this persistent and recurring threat, he is fully invited into the tribe, and he goes on a bit of a dream quest and in fact makes his own gaffy stick and is gifted with Tusken robes, which kind of sets him up for his appearance that we saw in the Mandalorian episode. So a lot happened there. Very, very well received episode. I should state that, you know, like I said, this really flowed on well from episode one, different pacings, but I don't think this episode would have worked quite as well if we didn't have episode one immediately preceding it. I like to think of these two story chapters as being strongly integrated together and sort of critical to think of them both as a single unit rather than thinking of one being a bit more of a slower prelude and one more a bit more of an action-packed secondary chapter.
A lot of new TV series tend to put out the first and second episodes together so that you get through all the kind of world building, scene setting and stuff like that. Obviously, Disney Plus shows come out strictly one episode at a time, certainly with the mainline ones like the Marvel and Star Wars series. So perhaps they would have run together a little bit better, but never mind. They're both out there now. You can watch them back to back.
One thing I just want to touch on before we dive into a lot of the detail, and there's some fantastic detail to really discuss and break down, is a few of the terminologies, the vocabulary that's cropping up. First of all, Boba Fett is being referred to as a daimyo. Daimyo is a Japanese concept, a Japanese word that means the feudal lords who were landowners who led powerful warrior bands and controlled provinces of Japan. So there is a mayor of Mos Espa, but the crime lords seem to be able to hold this power by owning land and controlling sort of mercenary armies. And even the mayor of Mos Espa is subservient to this concept in some ways. Right, so right from the get-go, we're seeing some really, really interesting bits and pieces in this episode. We got a teaser that there might be something in the Rancor pit, but that turned out to be empty. So somewhere along the line, they may decide to get a new Rancor. I don't know if that'll actually pan out, but it'd be kind of fun. But that was just a little bit of a scene setting to get them back to have a conversation with the mayor of Mos Espa. Fantastic to see a leading Ithorian character in this way. The character was, I believe, voiced by Robert Rodriguez. The Ithorians obviously had a translated voice as well as a natural voice running simultaneously, but the translated voice, I believe, is Robert Rodriguez. A very cool character. It looked like it was actually a physical animatronic in a number of the scenes, which was an interesting concept. But it works for this character. If that was in fact the case, we could be wrong. It's so hard to tell sometimes these days, we could be wrong. But it works well in this scene because he's just sitting there and he moves his hands and he has articulated mouth parts.
Hammerhead is a good alien species to do as a physical prop because they don't really have a moving mouth. It's kind of the little sort of gill type structures on the side of their heads. So it's a little bit easy, but the way that it kind of moved and blinked its eyes, it felt like a physical thing there in the space. And they also gave him sort of a little bit of fluff around certain points. And if you're going to try and do a TV show on a budget, you're probably not going to add random hair onto a, on a digital character that doesn't need to be there. Well, previous versions of Ithorians haven't really had a lot of hair.
Something we saw back in The Mandalorian, and I think it's probably going to pan out here, is that for a lot of the Think Creatures creations that were digital, there was, for close-ups, for some aspects, a physical prop version. Like, for instance, most of the blurgs were CG rendered, but for some of the close-ups, there were a couple of physical stand-in and props, and sometimes they CG'd over those and sometimes they didn't. I think that's probably the case for a lot of what we're seeing here. The massive dogs in the Tusken camps have some fantastic CG detailing and articulation and movement going on there, but it wouldn't surprise me if a couple of the scenes we saw, like when Boba Fett strangles one of them and then touches its face, if there are stand-in props, there's probably only one per creature. It almost wouldn't surprise me if there was a physical bantha for some of the scenes that we saw, although clearly some of the wider shots, the CG models.
The banthas in this episode in particular, I don't really think, I'd have to go back and double check, but I don't remember them appearing to walk. They generally stand there or fall over, and their head movements would be very easy to puppet because they're a big cavernous kind of creature with a lot of hair to sort of hide puppeteers underneath. So yeah, I think that would be...
We saw a herd of banthas from a distance, but that's not one of the main ones we're talking about. And last week we saw them walking in a train, but this week they weren't particularly mobile. And in fact, it's kind of struck me that when one of them got shot, it fell towards the camera and rather than away from the camera, and it almost made me think that was to hide whatever was underneath it.
Yes.
Okay, so the other really interesting thing about the opening scene was the appearance of the Hutts, the twins, a male and a female being carried on a litter, and the appearance of Black Crescenton. Now, Black Crescenton's a fantastic character to introduce at this point for a number of reasons. He's a well-established character, a very established personality and history. He was introduced and showed up a lot in the Dr. Aphra and Darth Vader comics, including going back to pre-A New Hope times, shortly after the Battle of Yavin. Darth Vader traveled to Tatooine on a mission to negotiate on behalf of the Empire for supplies with Jabba. And while he was there, he recruited bounty hunters from Jabba. The two bounty hunters he recruited for two separate missions were Boba Fett and Black Crescenton, who appeared in the comics together. That kind of goes part of the way to explaining the significance of the look that Black Crescenton gives to Boba Fett during this encounter. Black Crescenton, fantastically realized in terms of makeup, is played by a person called Cary Jones. Now, he is kind of interesting because his listing on IMDb shows that most of the work he's done in the film industry is actually in the makeup department. He was a supervisor on a large run of different programs, including most of the Walking Dead shows, and he's only occasionally shown up in front of the camera. He did play the tracker predator, one of the main predators from the 2010 Predators movie, which interestingly was co-written by Robert Rodriguez. So this is another one of those callbacks where people know people and use people that they know well and that they develop a relationship with and respect the work of. So it's quite a cool little bit of trivia, but yeah, obviously he's going to show up in a much more significant role down the line. And we know that for a number of reasons, partly speculation. But in some of the interviews we were talking about earlier, clearly both Ming-Na Wen and Temuera Morrison say the name with such ease that it's clearly something that's been a line that they have to speak, or a character that they're familiar with. So that just really reinforces that we expect a lot more out of this Wookiee character.
It's really fun to see these sorts of characters showing up, knowing that the wide number of the audience are not going to know what this character is, the importance of it and stuff like that, but pulling in things from the comics, characters that people like, ones that have sort of crossed paths with other major characters, is really quite fun. Certainly, I am definitely keen to see where this character goes in the series. You're not going to drop something like that in an episode just to kind of give a menacing look and then walk off. And of course, it's kind of fun seeing the fact that it's played by somebody that's played a tracker, a predator. Obviously, from the Predator franchise, they use, you know, performance artists, stunt people that have a very tall, a very muscular physique. So if you can pull off a predator, you can play a pretty menacing Wookiee. So that's kind of fun. Obviously, you'd have to know how to really sort of move and give a performance that doesn't really use your face much for that. But I really liked the portrayal. I can see a lot of people jumping in.
There's some serious good acting going on and some serious good makeup. The fact that he could give him the side eye glare with such intensity through the mask and makeup was fantastic.
I'm certainly hoping that this character has enough of a role that we see action figures of him. I always enjoyed the sort of cluster of the episode 3 Wookiees that we got that had all the varying different sort of armor and body types and hair colors. So you could kind of get like the whole sort of army of Wookiees to kind of army build for that scene on Kashyyyk. So I'm hoping see a Black Series version of this to start pulling out the Boba Fett.
So far all we know is that we're going to get action figures about Boba Fett and Fennec Shand. We're starting to see a really good array of action figures from The Mandalorian, including small role characters or versions of characters, like the version of Miggs Mayfeld in the Stolen Armor, for instance, and we've got Cosca Reeves and Q90 and so forth. So I'm really hoping to see from the Book of Boba Fett, Garza Flip, the Twi'lek. I'm really hoping it'll be quite cool to see the Ithorian, although I think he's possibly slightly less likely. I think the Tusken Chieftain and the main Tusken warrior played by stuntwoman Joanna Bennett.
Especially since that these characters, like the ones you've listed, have been appearing on the episodically released character posters on the official Star Wars channels. I think that that bodes well for both their involvement in the storylines and their possibility of turning up in merchandise.
The only challenge they're going to face is if they want to do something with those huts.
Yeah. That's going to be quite a deluxe set, isn't it? Because they're kind of not intertwined, but they sit very closely together. So I think you'd have to mold the figures almost interlocking the way that they sit. But yeah, that would be a very cool display if you had them. I guess it would be a little bit too hard to sort of balance them with like all the little servants holding it. that would be funny.
That would be interesting, but probably a bit much to expect. So that part of the episode only took up about a quarter to a third of the overall time span of the episode before we moved back to the flashbacks. Flashbacks were a story that's been told many times before, Boba Fett proving his worth, training montages of various sorts, some really cool aspects to them. Again, we're really starting to see development of this Tusken Raider Sand People culture, which is fun. We're seeing them distinguish themselves from other Tusken Raiders. We've seen that visually in terms of what they wear and how they decorate themselves, but we're seeing them actually describe that they, or acknowledge that they stand apart from other Tusken Raiders and being a clan that's kind of hidden a bit more than some of the others that have been a bit more active in terms of attacking and staking out their presence in their territory in an active way. The first appearance of the Pike train was really interesting. Quite dramatic the way it was seen in the distance, but the blaster bolts just, you know, came so fast and heavy across such a wide span. And clearly it's a recurring threat as the Pikes are transporting spice across Tusken land.
I think it was interesting. The first time you see it, you get a glimpse of whoever is riding the train as they fire out the window, but it's kind of a blink and you miss it moment. And I saw the sort of side of the helmet and I was like, is that a Pike? I think that kind of looks like the masks that they wear in Solo, A Star Wars Story. And then of course, when we get to them later, not only do we see that, yes, these are Pikes, but we see them with their masks off, which I thought was really fascinating. They didn't necessarily have to do that because that's a lot more cosmetic work to do, either digitally or physically on actors and stuff like that. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah. Oh, just speaking of creatures, just jumping back a quick second, one thing I noticed about Mos Espa was the large number of Trandoshans we were seeing on the streets, and I'm really liking what they've done in terms of facial prosthetics for a number of those, and I'm assuming that they're physical costumes for the ones we were seeing them just walk past because they weren't needing to be particularly articulated, but they look really cool. And yeah, I think we saw at least a couple of clusters of groups of two, three or more Trandoshans. People have been referring to them as judgy Trandoshans because of the way they side-eyed Fett and Shand as they walked down the streets of Mos Espa.
It definitely feels like it's building up to that scene that we saw in the trailers where Boba Fett's sort of sitting at the big table with a lot of Trandoshans talking about, let's work together. So I think they're establishing the fact that there is a fairly large presence of Trandoshans on Tatooine. They are a significant faction that he wants to collaborate with rather than have conflict with, possibly against the Hutts. Well, I guess we'll get to see that, but that's interesting.
Yeah.
So I really liked the sort of the continuation of lore building in this episode. We got so much more detail about Tusken Raiders and Tusken culture. Like you said, we find out that the little black orbs that they dig out of the sand are called black melons, and they for the most part seem to be what sustains Tuskens.
They spend a lot of time harvesting them, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of other nutritional resources.
No, we don't see them sort of killing things for meat. We don't see them cooking things on fires and stuff like that. So it feels like
That thought specifically crossed my mind when we saw the herds of bantha, which would be a source of nutrition, but they're obviously just using them to ride. That may be a vegetarian tribe.
Because when Boba Fett is talking about the Black Melon, he references that the Tuskens survive on its milk. Mm. And so we're fairly familiar with the concept of milk having a lot of nutrients and being able to sustain, you know, different organisms and things like that. So I think that's an interesting thing. Because obviously, I'm sure every seven-year-old playing with their vintage action figures had that thought, like, how do Tuskens eat? Do they take their masks off and stuff like that? But we see the Tuskens drinking from the melons without taking their masks off, and if they don't eat anything, then they don't actually need to take their masks off. And including after the first conflict with the train, we see them sort of having a funeral pyre. And I thought it was interesting that the Tuskens were basically, they looked like their bodies were wrapped a little bit, but their faces, the masks, were still visible. And you could see that they were being cremated with their masks on, that even in death, that sort of mask is never taken off, which I think is really interesting. It's kind of, you know, completely keeping them shrouded in mystery. I know we're all somewhat curious about what Tuskens really look like underneath, but I think that that's really interesting, keeping that secret, and sort of gave us a little bit more of sort of the Tusken culture.
So to break down the rest of the sequence of the episode, we had the Toshi Station encounter, then we had the train heist. The Toshi Station encounter was fantastic. A lot of people suspected that it was going to be Toshi Station because of the layout of the background. And if you look at the whole entire deleted scenes, which shows exterior shots from both angles as well as interior shots, the match is really, really cool. And the two main characters inside Toshi Station, apart from the Nikto gang, were in fact Cammy and Fixer, who are the Luke Skywalker's friends who show up in that original Toshi Station deleted scene. Really, really great callback and really good likenesses for those two characters. The gang looked pretty intimidating. A few big characters in there. Tim made short work of them.
I like how they gave it sort of like a little bit of a real world feel. They sort of felt like a biker gang. They sort of wore big jackets and things like that. And I thought it was fun that they established the fact that they're fighting with sort of electro staff weapons, because obviously Boba Fett at this point, he's got his sniper rifle, which isn't the best in close quarters. He ends up breaking it and then using his wooden sort of training gaffy stick for the rest of the fight scene, which was really quite fun because we're seeing him so much more proficient with the staff than when we saw him trying to battle the Tusken warrior in the first episode. So it was a good example of how much training has gone on, how much better he is. And I kind of like that little sort of nod, kind of referencing the scenes in episode 4 where Luke is talking about wanting to get off this rock, that, you know, he wants to go out and explore the stars and stuff like that. And then years later, we see his friends, Cammy and Fixer, still on Tatooine. So I think that sort of speaks to sort of the Tatooine being a far-flung place, and you've got to really try hard to get off or you'll spend the rest of your life there, which isn't to say that's a bad thing, but certainly from what we've seen of Tatooine, it's a pretty hard place to grow up. You know, it's all sort of, you know, gangs and crime lords and things like that. But I think it's kind of sweet. We don't specifically know if Cammy and Fixer are married or anything, but they're clearly still together, so I think that that's fun and as a callback to that sort of famous deleted scene. So I really enjoyed that touch, and I knew that fans were really hoping that they were sort of putting the pieces together from the few shots that we were getting from the trailers. And I think that that was really fun, that certainly the scenes, they didn't specifically say each other's names, I think, but they were confirmed in the credits, though they were credited as Cammy and Fixer. So that was really fun.
And in terms of the design of that scene, I think they knew they had to get all the details right, or it just wouldn't, that connection wouldn't read well, wouldn't come across, but it really worked because they did do that. So by way of that encounter, Boba Fett acquires, I think, about 5 speeder bikes maybe, and takes them back to the Tuskens. And we again have one of these training montages. Boba Fett teaches the Tuskens to ride the swoop bikes. Really cool design on those swoop bikes, by the way. They're clearly intended to look like they are, you know, powerful machines compared to some of the rudimentary vehicles we've seen in a few episodes. You know, the Lars speeder bike that Anakin uses back in the prequel trilogy is pretty rudimentary, and so are the ones that are used in The Mandalorian on a Tatooine episode.
certainly because these speeder bikes are all identical, it sort of feels like somebody's gone and sort of splurged some cash and bought a fleet. These aren't hodgepodged, you know, beaters that are sort of bits and pieces holding them together. And they're all kind of got like little gang signals and some artwork on there. I'm sure some eagle-eyed people will go through and blow up sort of screen cap images and try and decipher what these little, what these drawings on the sides mean.
So that scene leads to what, at least in my social media feed, seems to be one of the most prolific GIFs of the last week, which is Tamara Morrison sitting on a speeder bike mimicking the use of accelerators and describing it as being like a Bentley.
It was fun because obviously there's some harsh points to Tatooine and certainly Boba Fett's story up until this point, you know, getting out of the Sarlacc pit, nearly dead, and then being captured by the Tuskens. And now we're getting a slightly lighter part because now he's not fighting for his life, fighting for survival. He's feeling like he's more accepted and part of the Tuskens. And certainly he has his sort of more humorous moments. And then, of course, we see him being fully in the clan at the end. So I think that that's sort of really fun that he's not afraid to kind of, you know, be a little bit more lighthearted. He's not sort of constantly watching his back for some sort of grumpy Tusken to get at him or something. That in these scenes, he's really teaching them and they are sort of, you know, following his leadership, which is quite a, you know, significant. We're not really sure how much time has taken place. Clearly to get sort of a bit better and his training with the gaffy stick means that he is, some time has taken place, but it also his position within the clan has progressed as well. So I think we're seeing a fair passage of time.
Yep. And so the train heist itself, some really fantastic stunt choreography and fight choreography, works really well. And it shows different roles that the different characters are playing and achieving that. And we've got a few other, you know, specific visual aspects to that. The interior of the lead engine room of the train is kind of interesting with that freaky little four-legged spider droid runs out the window later. But yeah, all in all, that was, you know, quite a, obviously it went down really well in terms of an action-packed scene that read really well and came across really well.
Obviously, the setting of Sandy Tatooine has a lot of callbacks to sort of like westerns and things like that, where life is harsh and you're having to really sort of make do and determination.
Someone did a scene match between Lawrence of Arabia and the Tuskens coming down to the train, and it was, you know, it was an identical, inspired by a tribute to Lawrence of Arabia with the gang of Tuskens coming down to attack the train.
Yeah, a train heist is a really classic sort of movie element, and I think that this one did really well. Obviously, heightened by the fact that we've got what looks to be a massive pod racer engine on the front of it.
Yeah.
And certainly within the main sort of conductor room, we see a lot of panels that do remind me of when Anakin is moving power between engine and engine. It sort of gave off that sort of vibe, because obviously we're in Mos Espa, where the big pod racing scene takes place. So it kind of feels like they're giving us touches of the prequels and obviously heavy reference from Tatooine elements from A New Hope. It's really fun to sort of see this all come together.
So the aftermath of the heist scene was a big deal because we see a number of things taking place. We see the respect that the Tuskens have for Boba Fett at this point. We see the charisma and power, that the inherent power that Boba Fett kind of holds when he's communicating with the Pikes, communicating with the leader of the Pike Syndicate in that region at least. You know, there's just no question that he is the one that is controlling the situation as he sits there in his flight suit, and the Tusken hands him one of the melons for a drink. And, you know, I don't know if Tim has any contribution to this or if it is genuinely written this way, but it was a classic Tim moment when the Pike was feigning ignorance and said, what does spice look like? Tim's just like that. This is not looking good for you.
Yeah, I like those moments. I think Star Wars always does well with a little bit of humor. You know, even when, you know, stormtroopers are chasing them down corridors or TIE fighters are chasing them, you know, there was always Han Solo with something, you know, funny to say to add in there. And I really enjoy seeing that coming through. I sometimes feel like, yes, Din Djarin has a little bit of humor, but it was a bit more subtle. I think Baby Yoda tended to be the sort of the humorous element in that show. So it's kind of fun seeing a bit more humor coming through with Boba Fett. I think it makes the character really likable.
Yeah. Okay, so subsequent to that scene, the presumably the same evening, they actually have the evening after dark ceremony where the lizard guide is introduced.
Yeah.
So one way or another, this lizard needs to be introduced into Boba Fett's nasal cavity, his sinuses, and it interacts with his brain to cause hallucinations and or guide him. That was another quite cool scene, which really, you know, Tim's personality really came through. I loved the delivery of some of his lines. I loved that even though he's surprised, the way he conveyed that even though he's surprised at the gift of a lizard, he respectfully acknowledged that, I'll let this guy, the lizard, that even if
he doesn't understand the importance, he appreciated it's important for the Tuscans. So yeah. He received the gift with the sort of gratitude that he knows that they expect for that sort of gift.
And the bit that followed, I sort of interpreted that whether it was spice or some other chemical attractant, I think the powder that they flung at him, I guess he inhaled it, and my interpretation was that the lizard sort of just followed the path of the gas as he inhaled it into his nasal passages. But yeah, then we see the dream sequence, the wandering through the desert, and transpires that he was in fact wandering through the desert during that. So aspects of it were hallucinations, but other aspects of it were what was taking place.
Yeah, there were some really cool visuals in here. We see him sort of staggering through the desert, and it kind of flashes between him in his tattered flight suit as we see him and his original sort of Return of the Jedi armor with the light bodysuit. And then we see him come across what appears to be somewhat of a tree filled with red eyes. We don't really know what the red eyes are indicating here. And then it sort of flashes with scenes from when he was inside the Sarlacc pit, and he's sort of grappling with sort of bits of the Sarlacc pit and then branches of the tree. It kind of goes between them. We also see another flashback to young Boba Fett looking like Daniel Logan. We see young Boba on Kamino, and he's kind of running down a corridor watching Slave One take off outside. Obviously, he is watching his father, Jango Fett, flying off for some mission. This kind of made me feel like he spent some of his childhood feeling alone, like being left behind, because we know that Jango Fett was involved in some heavy stuff in episode 2. He was on Coruscant, you know, helping Zam try to assassinate Padme Amidala. So we know he must have gone on missions for the Separatists and things like
still
that.
Still worked as a bounty hunter.
Yeah, without Boba being there. And obviously he doesn't have a mother. He's got this sole sort of parental sort of role with Jango, and he wasn't always there. So you kind of get this really sort of sad moment. The sort of sorrow in his eyes watching his father sort of flying away. I guess as a young kid, if you know that your father's involved in dangerous things, you never know if they'll come back successfully. So you kind of get a bit of a vibe of that. And obviously, as he's going through all this turmoil, he wrestles with the tree branch to the extent where he rips a branch off. And then in the morning, we see him sort of slowly walking back to the Tuscans carrying this tree branch. And the lizard jumps out of his nose and then sort of back. And obviously, the wood is how he's going to make his own gaffy stick, which leads to another really cool sequence.
Yeah, so the weapons forge scene was fantastic. The instant it cropped up, it just sparked a flashback memory of my own to the tip-top RTD Space Ice stickers of our childhood, because that included a Ralph McQuarrie concept art showing a piece of starship debris with Tuscans hiding behind it, and that was clearly the inspiration for the weapons forge. They had a identical piece of curved starship hull as a sort of a shelter, and Tuscans standing on the shadowy side of it, and that was effectively replicated for this pivotal scene in this episode. And I think that was a really, really cool, really cool flashback that was not necessarily as, it wasn't as detailed or as overt as perhaps the Toshi Station one, but it was just a great sort of tribute to Ralph McQuarrie's contribution to the design of Star Wars, and in particular things like Tusken Raider culture, some of the things that weren't necessarily seen directly in the original trilogy now being used in that way.
Yeah, I thought that was a really neat touch. Yet again, another sort of reference that you know, longtime Star Wars fans will really appreciate and get excited for, and won't be too sort of stick out weirdly for people that don't understand the reference. I really did enjoy the sequence where he's making his gaffy stick. He's watching the warrior who trained him kind of, you know, do some bits and kind of show him what to do. And then we see him with great concentration sort of carving in the sculpture around the sort of the big heavy weapon head. We see them forging metal to craft the sort of bladed spiked end and stuff like that. And then once he is all done, we see him sort of in the evening, all the Tuskens, including the chief, appear to be sitting around a campfire, and he sort of shows them his staff. Of course, he has gotten his black Tusken robes in a sort of a dressing ceremony, which I think is quite neat. Black, so I feel like the black robes that the Tuskens give him is why he is now wearing a black flight suit under his new armor, as opposed to the pale one that we saw in Return of the Jedi. But once he sort of presents, shows off his finished gaffy stick in front of the Tusken chieftain, there is a scene where Boba and the warrior who trained him do a sort of a fight dance. It's obviously got some sort of tribal significance. And then everyone joins in, and it kind of really signifies the fact that he is now one of the tribe. And I feel like that is a really good, I could be wrong, but I feel like that is a really good closing point for his backstory. He's now got his robes, his gaffy stick, and we know that he is allowed to take a rifle, because we saw him take a rifle to Toshi Station. So I feel like that's a really good lead up to where we see him turn up in The Mandalorian. So I don't feel like we've got too much more of backstory to cover.
It's not 100% clear at what point the scenes where he goes into the, presumably it's the docking bay within Jabba's palace to see Slave One. Not quite clear which timeline that will play into, but we're yet to see that. But yeah, his interaction with the Tuskens is essentially over at this point, so we may see quite a different format with tomorrow night's episode.
The one thing I can think of is that maybe we'll get some sort of parting scene where he's like, okay, I need to go on my own quest to go get my armor back. Because it's, you know, like he talks about it's being sort of encoded to his father. And
whether
his,
actually reference
and his,
the
that,
events
yeah,
of the Mandalorian.
Whether they just talk about it, or whether they sort of show him sort of saying farewell to the Tuskens, I'm off on my journey. He's going to go find Slave One wherever
leave
he
it
parked
implied.
It.
Well, they may leave everything implied, because at the point that episode closed, he doesn't know. He may presume that it was the Jawas that took his armor, but he doesn't know that it's been, you know, passed on to Cobb Vanth at this point. So they may just leave that all implied, or we may see that tied together a little bit more directly and a little bit more concretely. Yeah,
I don't mind either way.
No, I don't mind either way.
I feel like it wrapped up very well. We don't need too much sort of joining the dots here to figure out that he would have talked to people. Maybe he came across Jawas and they're like, oh yeah, we found it somewhere and we sold it to this.
They don't need to rehash the Mandalorian episodes in complete detail. Yeah. But if they they may reference it in a new or interesting way from
because
a slightly different perspective.
We know that we see him looking on the Slave One. We don't know where that shot will fit into the storyline. We don't know if that will just be a quick flashback or whether that will be part of these sort of longer sequences before we get. But I'm really excited with how, I know it's a bit of a slow burn, but I feel like this isn't a big flashbang. I feel like because we're dealing with an established character that has huge chunks of time missing from his story, that it was going to have to be full of what happened. If they just skipped over what happened after the Salak pit, everyone would be mad.
When it's all done, I think these are going to string together for binge watching insanely well.
Yes. I can just see
there'll be a fluctuating tempo, which is just necessary so you don't just burn out of exhaustion watching something. But I think that everything's going to tie together fantastic for binge watching at the end of it.
I feel like the attention to detail and the little elements from Star Wars lore going all the way back to Macquarie art, like, you know, pre A New Hope, all the way through to some of the modern era comics and deleted scenes. We're seeing this constant pulling together of references, and it feels really respectful. And I don't feel like they would just suddenly, you know, like when we see the whole thing crafted in its entirety, I think it's going to fit together really, really well, as a book should do. You know, books don't always start with like the drama at the start. You know, we get the story building, we get the establishing shots and things like that. And then we really build into the crux of it in sort of the middle of the book. And then we figure out what we're going to do. So I feel like it's following along from that. Certainly if we think about, you know, some of the Star Wars movies, you know, the big action starts, you know, towards the middle of the movie. You know, the Clone Wars don't break out at the start of episode 2. They break out at the end of episode 2. You know, that's, I feel like I'm really enjoying the pacing of it. I don't need a lot of action sequences. I like the character building scenes in this, and I really love all the Tusken Raider scenes. I think they're really quite fascinating. I love finding out more about this classic. They're one of the very first Star Wars creatures you ever see in the movies, along with the Jawas, you know, so it's really fun to sort of see more exploration there. Like, we did get a little bit of Jawa lore in The Mandalorian. We saw the off-world Jawas and their reverence for the Mudhorn egg and things like that, you know, so we got a little bit, but I really enjoy the Tuskens, the concept that they reference that there used to be oceans and water on Tatooine, but it's all dried out, and that the very different Tusken tribes are sort of scattered and they're sort of different. I really like that lore. I like how sort of similar but different they feel to the different Tuskens we've seen in the movies. Obviously, they have quite a process of sort of a warrior, a deeply sort of honor, because we see Boba Fett in The Mandalorian pledging to Din Djarin that he will not stop until the child is safe in exchange for his armor. And even when he gets his armor fairly quickly, he, you know, goes on this prolonged adventure to go rescue Grogu from the Empire. And it sort of feels honor bound. And I think, like, there's a little bit of the Tusken honor in there.
Yeah, sure thing. So, yeah, really, really fantastic episode. Really appreciated the fact that it was a nice long episode, over 50 minutes in total duration, a little bit shorter with the credits chopped off. And, yeah, leading up to another great episode tomorrow night. We're super excited to see that and talk about it in the podcast next week. And in between those times, we'll also be talking about it straight after it screens, in fact, in our Villa Varacino Twitch stream, which we'll have links for below. So if you want to join us for discussion straight after tomorrow night's episode, jump over to our Twitch channel and we'll have a bit of a conversation with anyone in the audience about what we've just seen and how great it inevitably will be. But that's about it for today's installment. I guess we are done doing talking. If you have any thoughts on the topics we discussed today, what are your thoughts on this episode 2 of The Book of Boba Fett? We're definitely keen to hear them. Leave a comment on the YouTube page or on our website page for this podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you taking your time to listen to us share our passion for Star Wars. Stay tuned to our website, swnz.co.nz, for Star Wars news for New Zealanders and another podcast episode next week and every Tuesday. And don't forget, you can jump on over to either our Facebook group or the SWNZ message boards to discuss all the latest Star Wars news with other Kiwi fans. Kia ora, kia noho, haumaru. Thank you for listening and stay safe.
Tūro Hawaiki. May the Force be with you.